with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I'm hoping that this evening will be an opportunity for collegiality, concourse, common cause, that kind of thing, conversation, beyond what conversation radio ordinarily is. This is a freighted evening, brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors. This is a freighted evening. Here in about 2 hours, President Johnson, Obama, is going to commit more troops to Afghanistan. And therein, Obama, is going to announce to the world that he has no intention of seeking re-election to the presidency of the United States in 2012, no matter what the timeline may say. In about 2 hours, Obama, is going to lift his elegant middle finger at the middle class and working class and lower class of this country and say, "Hey, you know, it's what you are. Welcome to plebehood." In about 2 hours, Obama. Dang, why do I keep confusing the two? I don't know. But in about 2 hours, President Johnson. All right, this is getting silly. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to make health care less likely. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to put the final nail through any hope, through the coffin of any hope for universal single-payer health care in my lifetime and probably yours, no matter how young you may be. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to put the hopes of making real progress on the otherwise debilitating killing of this planet practically nil. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to make college a lot less affordable for working and middle-class families, middle-class, what's left of it. In short, in about 2 hours, President Obama is going to tell all of America, "Who gives a F what you think?" We've heard somebody else make that statement before, haven't we? If you think that I find some joy in saying something like this, you are sadly mistaken. I voted for Barack Obama. I advocated his election. I didn't have any money to give him. But I did everything in my power, and I have taken hell in this little race-baiting community where I live for my vote. My children have been called nigger lovers because we voted for Barack Obama. We have stood up for Barack Obama, and Barack Obama is telling us to shove it. Now, I am not in the least prone to say, "Well, you know, that's it. I'll never vote for him again." I won't do that. I don't like operating that way. But I will say this. He is making it incredibly difficult to continue to support him. Everything, everything in the world points away from the disastrous path that he is about to take and will take tonight at the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York. Everything. And yet he will. I have children, you know. And I had hoped with the end hopefully coming of the Iraq debacle that there might be a chance that I would not no longer have to fear that they, living in an impoverished region of Appalachia, would not face that Hobson's choice of the military during a time in which we were engaged in military stupidity. Tonight, Barack Obama is telling me that, you know, maybe just somewhere along the way, he might need some more bleeding human flesh for his adventure in Afghanistan, and that maybe my kids might need to be some of that meat. Our friend Reverbo calls in from time to time and ends every phone call with one statement. Make it personal. And I tell you, it is personal. It's personal for a lot of you. A lot of you saw the hell and damnation that was unleashed on America by the evils of Vietnam and its aftermath. And you know the road we are traveling. You know it full well. And for some, I am damn well certain that there are tears welling in your eyes, not by anything I'm saying, but by virtue of the knowledge that you have of what evil this means. I had an email earlier today from our buddy David in Tennessee. I want to share it with you. Having watched Keith Olbermann's special comment last night, David sent me the following note. When Nixon's ball of wax was beginning to melt, I told the world we had two choices. If we accepted Nixon at his word, and his problem was all the doing of his underlings, he was an out-of-touch tower dweller, far removed from doing his job. Alternatively, if he were in command of the plumbers, he was the president most dedicated to ruining the office, possibly of and for all time. Boy, did those choices piss off most everybody. And by way of editorial comment, I said the same thing about Ronnie Reagan during the Iran-Contra affair. What? He didn't know? All this crap was going on, money funneled here, money diverted there, arms to the Iranians in exchange for the hostages, and the profits were then diverted to the Central American terrorists in Nicaragua. And he didn't know? Then he should be impeached for simple misfeasance of his job. Oh, wait, he knew? Well, that one's easy. But that's when Katherine Graham or somebody came along and said, you know, the American people cannot withstand another constitutional crisis. No, the American Republic can always withstand a constitutional crisis. What we cannot withstand is too many more crises of backbone. Because we're living without a lot of it. So to get back to what David said, now we have Barack Obama. Is he the empty suit, as Kate has said, triangulating and polling his way to that second term by any means necessary? Or has he become a dupe and a stooge of those that love and profit from war? I am not at all impressed with his coming actions, even if they are some mind trick to give both sides what they want till October of 2010. Damn, if the plan is to head fake a larger war and then tell us, look, see there, the Afghans aren't doing their part, we're leaving now. If that's the plan, F him. Leave now, damn it! The Afghans were the Afghans, are the Afghans, and will remain the Afghans. 1, 2, or 3 years of our people dying there will not change the place. In closing, David says, this whole thing pains me. Amen. For my part, I was engaged in a little discussion today about how so-called environmental groups should respond to this escalation. And I said, you know, for me it was like, what, there's a question? You're not sure? Maybe we should support this? And I'm not talking about any of the environmental groups that you're familiar with, that I'm familiar with me being associated with. I'm not talking about that. And I just said, damn, look. Here we sit in the middle of Appalachia. Hill people being bombed daily by corporate America and poisoned thereby by heavy metals. You know, mercury, selenium, you know. On the other side of the planet is Afghanistan. Hill people being bombed daily by munitions made by corporate America and toxified by heavy metals. Depleted uranium, lead. Same, same. God Almighty, if I'm an environmentalist, then I have a duty to oppose this. This ramping up of the nightmare in Afghanistan. I have a duty to oppose it. Not a preference. Not a coin toss. Not an, you know, well, if you get the chance, you might want to think about saying something. No, I have a duty. I have something that lies upon my heart and my soul and the core of my integrity to oppose this. Because if I, a part of a community that is assaulted by 3.5 million pounds of high explosives a day, if I can look away from Afghanistan, then the rest of the godforsaken world can look away from me. And mine. And my friends, and we dare not call out to the rest of the country and say, see the plight that is going on in Appalachia. Why should they care? I will not be the second traveler on the road to pass the wounded, beaten man. I will not be. Call me a filthy hippie. Call me a tree hugger. Call me unclean. Call me what you will, but say that when people were under siege, that when human beings' very lives were in the balance, that I at least had the moral courage to stand up and say, God damn it, no! And if you can say that of me, then I can sleep at night. And I can have a clear conscience. So that's my side of it. To offer you another side, from the internet's most brilliant satirist, and all-around brilliant man, Eugene Finnerman at FinnermanWorks.com. He dropped me a note letting me know that this was going to post. A little piece called How to Conquer Afghanistan. How can Barack Obama succeed where Sean Connery and Michael Caine failed? Before his impending performance of the man who would be president, Mr. Obama should first consider the successful invasions of Afghanistan. Yes, contrary to the media's incessant references to the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan has been conquered a number of times. The Russians certainly failed. But Afghanistan has succumbed to the Persians, the Greeks, the Mongols, and even the British. And do you think the country became Muslim just through Arab charm? History tells us that there are two different approaches to conquering Afghanistan. The first may be summarized as force and finesse. This strategy concedes that Afghanistan is practically ungovernable, and the best you can do is to tilt the anarchy in your favor. Conquer Kabul, anyone can do that, and then start negotiating with the various tribes that actually rule the region. In return for acknowledging your titular control, you will ally yourself with one tribe against another. Try picking the most grateful or least treacherous tribe. And that really can be the challenge. This was the Persian approach, and after 3 years of fighting mountain to mountain, Alexander adopted it too. He even married the daughter of a tribal chieftain, that rare instance when politics makes straight bedfellows. Alexander, however, thought that Bactria, as Afghanistan was then known, could use another tribe, a colony of Greeks. Eugene's not kidding. He even built towns for these outposts of Hellenization. The city of Kandahar, as we've noted on this program, originally was named Alexandria. The Greek hold of Bactria lasted some 2 centuries, and their culture pervaded beyond those borders. In northern India, the statues of Buddha looked remarkably like Apollo. The British Empire had no real interest in Afghanistan, as it has been known since the 18th century. But it was an unruly neighbor of India, which the British did dearly covet. So the British thought that a show of force might induce some tranquility among the warring Afghan tribes. In 1839, a British army of 21,000 occupied the major cities of Afghanistan and anointed a pet prince to be the region's emir. There was so little resistance that nearly 2/3 of the army returned to India. However, the British optimism proved premature. Of the 3,600 men stationed in Kabul, one survived the ensuing massacre in 1842. A British army invaded Afghanistan, but only to safely rescue and evacuate the besieged British garrisons in other Afghan cities. Afghanistan returned to a sovereign state of chaos. You can guess the fate of the British-designated emir. Britain was resigned to Afghan anarchy and brigandage, but not an emir who allied himself to the Russians. In 1878, the prospect of Russian encroachment on India led Britain into another Afghan war. A British army of 40,000 invaded the country. The emir conceded to London's demands, and as the British forces were withdrawing, the British embassy staff at Kabul was massacred. It is, after all, an Afghan tradition. Back came the British army, and out went the emir. He would spend the next 43 years in India as a guest of the British. Spot of tea? Oh, really? You can't drink it? What, hanging by your thumbs? Well, blimey. The British replaced him first with his brother, and then with an even more compliant cousin. He and his successors reached an understanding with the British. They could expect a generous allowance in pounds sterling. They were free to determine Afghanistan's domestic policies, if any. But they need not bother with a foreign policy. London would make those decisions. This little arrangement lasted until 1919. So President Obama has these precedents in force and finesse. The real challenge in this strategy is picking the right stooge. The second approach to Afghanistan can be expressed as annihilation or else. This was how the Arabs marketed Islam. In the 7th century, religious fanaticism and cavalry made Islam nearly irresistible. Even the desolation of Afghanistan was little hindrance to an army accustomed to the deserts of Arabia. Yeah, when you've come out of the desert of Arabia, everything else looks like a salad bar. It really does. The conquered pagans were presented with a compelling argument for Islam, conversion or death. Since the indigenous theological mix of Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and animism had not proved much of a protection, the Afghans conceded to the superiority of Allah. Genghis Khan also applied this approach, although he did not offer any theological solace. For a 13th century barbarian, he was a pioneer in mass communication. Genghis offered free samples of massacres and then let word of mouth do the rest. The towns that did not comply with immediate and abject surrender would learn the Mongol hobby of collecting decapitated heads and building them into pyramids. Such recreation perpetuated Mongol rule in Afghanistan for more than four centuries. Over time, the Mongols did convert to Islam. Jihads and harems had such a spiritual appeal. Known by the more Arabic pronunciation of Mogul, they overran India and made Islam so very popular there. Annihilation or else was most recently used by the Soviets in Afghanistan. They had the prerequisite ruthlessness for the strategy, but not the necessary budget. War's more expensive than it used to be. The Soviet Union was a fourth-rate economy trying to prop up a world empire. Muhammad and the Quran might inspire threadbare soldiers to conquer. Leonid Brezhnev and imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, did not incite the same level of heroics. The Soviet soldiers probably were willing to trade their tanks for food. So, annihilation or else can be effective when practiced by religious fanatics or sociopaths. But they lost the last election here. You know, the religious fanatics and the sociopaths. Furthermore, the American public certainly would rather commit war crimes against Venezuela, Iran, or France. No, President Obama will choose some variation of force and finesse. Bribes and half measures are, after all, the American way. And now you know the ironic story. How can we know this? How can a brilliant Jeopardy champion sitting in some proximity to Chicago, a smart-ass hillbilly deep in the Appalachians, a southern man in the outliers of Nashville, and everyone else who has written to me about Afghanistan, how can we all know this and Barack Obama not? How is that possible? And, of course, that takes me back to the inquiry that that David made. And that is the either-or, and the either-or is absolutely... you don't want to be either-or. Neither of the things that Barack Obama is, according to David, is anything that any human, any self-respecting human being would want to be. Is he the empty suit, as Kate has said, triangulating and polling his way to that second term by any means necessary? Or has he become a dupe and a stooge of those that love and profit from war? Quick, anybody. Anybody want to be number one? Cold, calculating, cynical, triangulating, polling, anything for personal advancement. Anybody want to be that? Anybody? Bueller? Okay, how about a willing dupe and stooge of multi-billionaire war profiteers? Anybody? Bueller? Anybody? Hello? Is this thing on? No, nobody wants to be that either. There is a third choice. There is most assuredly a third choice. But it seems abundantly clear that Barack Obama will not choose it. That third choice is to be enlightened, humane, practical, decent, and dare I even say it, Christian. And he won't be any of them, because in order to be all that, he would have to stand at West Point this evening and say, guys, here's the skinny. Everybody coming home. Winter has already fallen on the Hindu Kush. The snows are already coming. The bitter winter winds that howl down through the valleys of Afghanistan have already grown their teeth and sharpened them on the rocky ledges of distant mountains. It is time to tell those whom we love so very much that we remember them, and that remembering them, we will not leave them to an unkind fate in a distant hellhole. It is time to bring them home. Say what you will of me, I care not. Do as you wish, I care not. They're coming home. They're starting now. Can you imagine such a president with the guts to make such a statement? I think even the right wing, who will not, by the way, be appeased by 30,000 more troops, because if Barack Obama sends 30,000, they'll say it should have been 60. If he sends 60, they'll say it should have been 120. If he sends 100, if he sends 500,000 of America's finest young men and women to die in Afghanistan or simply languish there, the right wing will scream that it should have been a million. If we kill one in three Afghan wedding parties, the right wing will want two in three dead. If we kill two in three, they'll want to abolish marriage in Afghanistan. For you see, for all that they talk about being servants of Jesus Christ, the right wing are very plainly worshippers at the altar of Ares, of Mars, of that god so drenched in blood that the very planet that bears his name is red. It's said that in the ancient empire, the legions were most fond of the Mithras cult. And of course, the Mithras cult does bear some resemblance to Christianity in its particulars. And we don't have anybody around to ask exactly what went on at the Mithraic initiation. But we have some hints. We know that the initiate stood in a pit and had a live bull slaughtered over him, drenching him in the hot, steaming blood of that bull. And that having been washed in the blood, that soldier was then purified to go forth and do the bloody business of empire. That is the cult of the right wing. The worship of Ares, the worship of Mars. being washed in the blood of people the world over and called upon periodically to wash others in their own. And it is nothing with which I wish any part. Half past the first hour of the program, and we will go straightways to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Oh, listen, you know, I was just sort of, not even like I'm in a serious conversating mood, but I just have to touch base with you on this, because this is, I am just sort of flabbergasted by this shit. This is, I mean, I know we're a country of 300 million people, and that's a lot, okay? But this is, you know, I can't even believe this is happening. This is, I don't know, it's unbelievable. I just needed to touch base to someone who can at least appreciate the gravity. You know, I am just so, I don't know. I know I sound crazy, but you know, it's just stunning that this fool, is going to put out rationale for escalating. I'm like, where the hell am I? What, you know, what is this?
Who put the pod under the guy's bed that we elected president?
No, and it's just the whole build-up of the media. The media is so disgusting and despicable, and the West Point setting. I'm like, you know what? We've seen this movie before. And it's not funny because it just rolls on. Like, the 300 million people don't matter. We're out of the show. Exit stage right, I guess.
Oh, we're not, you know, we don't really understand, Sandra. We don't have a real appreciation of the global implications failing to and you know, this is the part where, you know, you start speaking in tongues like Lindsey Graham. You know, I had that soundbite from him last night where he said, "Well, some pretty heavy hitters are going to be watching us to see how we handle this here Afghanistan."
The elite have gone, they're just whacked out. This is just absurd, you know? I mean, I don't know if I made the mistake. I mean, I'm not saying it's a mistake, but I read, what's his name at Salon? Green?
Glenn Greenwald, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, he just makes some devastating comparisons. It's just like, you don't even need to, it's not even like he's being on one side or another. He's just writing. It's just stunning. The whole exercise is really doing my head in. And I'm not at all sure, outside of chatting with you, what the hell to do, you know?
And I don't either. Apparently we don't matter. The people who elected Barack Obama do not matter, Sandra. Because what I think he's hoping to do is this is supposed to be, and I'm just trying to sort of put my head into the way they think there. This is supposed to be 30,000 human beings, 30,000 mothers, sons, and daughters are supposed to be the centrist path. Granted, it's not the 500,000 that the hardcore right wing would want, or perhaps atomic warfare, I don't know. And it's not, it's not the complete withdrawal that you and I would like to have. So we're just going to send 30,000 because that's centrist.
Well, no, that Orwellian. I hate to keep bringing up, dude, but it's just like this whole administration is becoming just Orwellian. Because ain't that fool going to pick up a peace prize too?
That would be this week.
What the hell? I mean, come on, you know. I mean, I'm not a huge theater person, but boy, you know.
They could send one of those little emails through the series of tubes to President Obama from Norway and just say, you know, never mind.
Well, no, but it's just, I mean, the whole thing, the speech at West Point, I mean, all of it, come on. You know, it's just...
Oh, and the details are no prettier. Last night, David from Tennessee speculated that, you know, maybe he'd say, okay, we're going to surge and then we're going to get everybody home by July 2010. And with something like that we'd kind of have to say, well, you know, that's leaving Afghanistan and that, but no, Everybody's going to be home something like maybe July of 2011. So he's pinning this on his reelection bid.
Not the midterms
in 2010. No, those people get hung out to dry too. It's not just us; it's them.
Haven't we seen this before, though?
Sadly, yes.
I mean, I know. I'm just, you know, it's like, how do I explain to you? You heard my little nieces in the back of the car that one time, right? Forever giggling.
Yeah, right.
How do I explain? You know, these girls are going to get bigger and bigger, and it's just been a war. All right. That's it. They're like seven. You know what I mean?
Well, exactly. You know, I think.
You know, nothing's going to pay attention to it. You know what I'm saying? But, yeah.
But someday they'll grow up and they'll get to where Cassie is. You know, she's a high school senior. And she said, you know, Bob, we've been in war almost as long as I've been in school.
Right. You know? And it's just sort of, you know, I got some other little younger boys who are, you know, 12 now. You know what I mean? I'm starting to think, wow, you know, is that what's waiting for these young men? You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, I do.
And it's because that's the only way I can process it, Bob, is, you know, just looking around at the little ones that, you know, are in my life, right? And I just am like, wow, this is not what I want to be going on in this country. I don't want a country that can't help its people economically and just become this kind of perpetual war. Maybe I'm not clever enough to see what's going on, but this just seems...
No. This is you're plenty clever. And frankly, this kind of triangulation is too cute by half.
Yeah, well, no. And I hate to say it, but Mr. Obama, you are not Bill Clinton. So I don't know how far he thinks he can take the triangulation. You see what I'm saying?
Well, apparently he thinks he can ride it around the block as much as he wants to.
No, but it's just the big problem with what he's doing is that. Yeah, maybe his base won't be enthusiastic. No, his base, I got a lot of books to read. You know, you understand what I'm saying, Bob? I won't, you know, they won't come out. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah, I'm doing my hair.
You know, whatever. I'm trying to prepare for this class. You know what I'm saying? They will tune out if they can, you know?
Well, see, and that's the other thing. This, he played hope and change to very great effect. And that did get a lot of kids out. What's the slogan for 2012, Sandra?
Yeah, right. No, no.
No, I mean, for 2012, is it, no, really, the change is going to happen now? That, you know, that's too wordy.
No, I just think that the face has been revealed, to be honest, because where are you going to hide, really? Where do you hide except to embrace whatever the F you're doing? You know, I can't see I don't see how they're going to craft a new slogan. What are they going to say? And that's what scares me. It's like, it looks like it's like tough titty, deal with it. You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's what I said. You know, it's we talked a couple of weeks ago about that 4th of July appearance where George Bush went to Philadelphia and the guy shook his hand in line and said, you know, you're a terrible president. And George looked at him and said, who gives a what you think? Well, this is Barack Obama's who gives up what you think moment.
Right, and it's just sort of,
I mean, is there a little bit, let me ask this, is there a little bit of pity to be had for Barack Obama in this, where he, you know, where if you could catch him in an unguarded moment, he'd say, listen, have you seen these generals? They'll kill me!
Well, yeah, no, I mean, of course, you know, that can also run through my mind, but on the other hand, the last time I heard, nobody put a gun to his damn head to be president.
To make him run. You wanted the job, now do the job.
Cops, no one put a gun to their head to be cops. You know?
I'm sorry. I just, that whole little song and dance is like, dude, you know. But that makes me think that, he's fully embraced it. And if that's the case, I guess that's what we're dealing with now, Bob. And that's the thing that I'm sort of...
It may be, Sandra. And just another place that I went in my weird little way of thinking... long about January the 20th, 2009, there were a lot of people out there saying things like, Dr. King's dream has finally been fulfilled.
Oh, please, no, I never went that far. Come on now.
No, you didn't, but others did. and the fact of the matter is, I thought about that today, and it just turned to ashes in my mouth.
Well, the most honest thing Obama has ever said was that one of those debates when someone asked, or what do you think King would blah, blah, blah about him running? And he said, well, King wouldn't be involved in this process at all. He would be in the street. Remember that comment?
Yep.
I was like, that's interesting.
And, but, yeah, and the other thing is Dr. King if in fact it's one of those cases where he's, you know, in that private unguarded moment says, you know, these crazy ass generals will have me killed. The difference between Barack Obama's and Dr. King's, Dr. King knew it. What? They're going to kill me. And he didn't stop. And he didn't say, well, you know what, we're going to just kind of go and sit down and sit back and, you know, no more lunch counter for a while and no more sit-ins. And you garbage workers in Memphis, you know, you're just a bunch of, why don't you be quiet and let me just work on this behind the scenes for a little bit.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, because, you know, it's just what he was, you can't even compare the two. That's why any of that kind of chat was always sort of, I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. I couldn't even rest on it because it was so absurd, you know what I mean? I understand the connection because it's a black man, blah, 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 but no, that's just a little bit too thick, you know? But at the end of the day, though, you know, this, yeah, I can't even believe this is happening. And this whole speech, I can't wait to sort of hear what the hell he's supposed to be saying. Now, he's escalating, yet bringing it to an end. Is that the Orwellian spin we got going?
Yeah, it's an escalation, and we'll escalate, and as quick as we're done escalating, we'll come home. But quick as we're done escalating means just in time for the November 2012 elections so that he can stand on the stump, so that he can stand there at his nominating convention and say, and I promised you that I would end the war in Afghanistan, and I have.
Okay, and so is the, well, what's happening on the in the progressives? I mean, are they embracing it, or?
No! Not that I can see. Everybody's...
I just wondered.
No. I mean, no. I mean, nobody... It's up the flagpole, and very few in the liberal progressive community are saluting.
Okay, because, you know, I just wonder, because, people are willing to sort of extend for Obama, which, yeah, I do understand. But we seem to be at the, well, you guys ain't going nowhere anyway, so, you... So that's.
But, you know, this is nothing. How can I put this? This is sort of a really big FU to the liberal community, but it's not the first FU to the liberal community by a long shot.
The
gay community got FU'd, the environmental community largely got FU'd. What community didn't? In the liberal community, get a big FU. You know, all the while that the right wing scream, he's as liberal as Mao.
No, it's true. But, I mean, this particular thing just flies in the face. It's just so absurd because the same man and his middle, whatever party he got going on, they turn around and start talking about this deficit BS. You know what I mean? Including Obama and their sort of, entitlement reform euphemism for trying to decimate that BS, and at the same time, this is going on. You see what I mean? You don't have to be paying attention to see if there is something wrong. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And the fact
it's just blatant.
Yes, And I think in a way that's kind of what's so damn shocking. I mean, there's not even pretense on this. It's just, you know, straight up, screw all of you. Who do you think you are?
No, but then we
what do you think you did, elect me or something?
And then we're going to have to watch them come talking about how they need to dismantle the last vestige of, you know, the New Deal. And it's a Nixon to China moment, you know what I'm saying? And it's scary. See, that scares me.
But, you know, Kucinich is spot on all of this, okay? Dennis Kucinich, I guess, sometime like around now or maybe a few minutes ago, appeared on MSNBC to talk about this, and it'll probably show up on YouTube in a matter of almost instantaneously. But just by way of a little statement, Congressman Kucinich said that he will address the whole thing tomorrow. But he says in the interim, the community I represent in Cleveland, Ohio, is suffering from massive unemployment, record home foreclosures, and small business failures. People are losing their jobs, their health care, their homes, their savings, their investments, and their retirement security. The middle class is gravely threatened. What is happening in Cleveland is occurring nationwide. Yet Wall Street received over $13 trillion in bailouts, with untold millions for high salaries and bonuses, while Main Street loses its power through unemployment, reduced wages and benefits, and little or no access to credit or investment capital. There is something fundamentally wrong with our economy, which borrowing more money to spend on war cannot and will not cure. Perhaps nation building should begin at home. An escalation of the war in Afghanistan at a time of such economic dislocation and hardship raises questions about America's priorities and whether or not we are losing our way as we attempt to stride aside the globe as some colossus. Tomorrow we will begin anew the discussion.
That is just it. That whole idea of us doing this escalation in the face of what Kucinich just described in a nutshell. And I think that is what's really troubling to me, you know? It is not that...
Because understand, yeah, Sandra, this means that everything ends. This means everything ends because there's an actual number out there of how much per day it costs to keep a soldier in Afghanistan. And it is a staggering sum.
Yeah, but the thing is, this isn't even real politics that's going on internationally. This is absurd. It's not even real. The realists would say you need to pull back. You can't afford to do this. State preservation is paramount. And this action is not preserving the state. It's putting the state at risk.
No, it's not real politic at all. What it is it is an exercise in profound national hubris. And underneath this little ugly act of hubris, which, as we recall from our Greek tragedy, never ends well, because it's the hubris that gets you brought down, underneath the hubris is this ugly little thing, this nasty little phrase called American exceptionalism.
Oh, please. Yikes.
Yeah, I know, but we both know what American exceptionalism is, right? That's that hubris that says just because everybody else failed, well, all that needs to happen is for Americans to do it, and it'll happen as it will succeed as if by magic because we are America.
I mean, it's a city on the hill, that whole fairy tale, you know. I don't even know what's going on. It just seems to be so wrong-headed, and we have to hear this speech telling us that we're still in danger somehow. I'm in danger by what's going on with these freaks.
Yeah.
I don't know about Al-Qaeda, but I know about these Democrats, and I say that because everyone's in at all levels of power now, right?
Well, and in many instances, refusing to wield the power that we gave them to wield.
Well,
we didn't put them there for bipartisanship. We put them there to correct the ship of state and change course away from the damned iceberg. But they don't want to.
No, that's the thing, you know, and it's just sort of, you know, of course, these numbers, 1 in 8 on food stamps.
Yeah.
Well, what the hell?
And you know, remember what that means. That's 1 in 8 human beings in this country are living on $3 a day of food assistance.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. When it's discussed, they always seem to forget the pittance that it is, you know.
It's lower than pittance. It really is.
And no, but just the scope of that gap, it's obscene, okay? And I think that's, you know, I think that's what my problem is. It's just bowled over by the obscenity of it all. I mean, it makes me sick.
But we do know that hubris gets punished. What happens to us? What does this cost us, Sandra?
No, it's going to cost us, though. This is what I'm saying.
Right, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. This is not our hubris. You know, remember, you know, and I'm not trying to be too obtuse, but remember, Oedipus met his daddy at the crossroads, and he didn't know it was his daddy. It was just some asshole who was harassing him, so he fought him and killed him. And he goes on in, the king is dead, he becomes king, he marries his mama, he doesn't know it's his mama. And does everything that a married couple does, and they have children. And then the gods send a plague to Thebes. And who dies? People who had absolutely nothing to do with what Oedipus did at the crossroads or did with his mama. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, there are so many layers and so many lessons that go unlearnt and untaught in this sort of ancient archetypal wisdom that undergirds the very nature of the human condition, and that's one of them. You know, it's a tragedy, and Oedipus has to claw out his eyes, yada yada yada. But people died in the streets of Thebes because of what Oedipus had done unknowingly, and the gods punished the people who had absolutely nothing to do with it. And that's what's going to happen in America, Sandra.
Well, no, I mean, it's like, yeah, I just, you know, I see they do this, and then all of a sudden, everything's going to come to a stop because they have to get the deficit under control. And these idiots, because they've paid themselves handsomely, they're all sorted, they're going to say, okay, it's time for us to raise the interest rate. When they raise the interest rate from zero that they have now, all hell's going to break loose in this country again for us.
Right.
And on the other hand, at the moment, they're just leaving them at zero. So you have this carry trade problem where bubbles are being inflated around the world. The mother of all bubbles is being inflated because you can borrow dollars at zero and go invest it in all kinds of currencies all over the world, Bob. Okay?
Yeah.
And it's just a joke. I mean,
well, you know, it's one of those moments where you drag Hunter Thompson out of the cannon's mouth or wherever it was he wound up, you know, to repeat for us what he was saying all through the 90s. Big darkness soon come.
Well, I don't know. I don't, you know, I'm just sort of, because see, the juxtaposition of all I can hear is whether or not Tiger talks to the police, and now I have to look at Obama, you know, getting his war on, you know? There's just sort of nothing in between, right?
Right. Well, I think it was Keith Olbermann last night who said, you know, as of tomorrow night, you become the war president, Mr. Obama.
Olbermann and whoever, you know, in the hopes of, what, shaming him or bringing him to his senses or something. But I just think that that ship has sailed because he's made his choice. You know, we all have to make choices, right?
Sure.
And I don't know who this choice is going to be good for. I guess that's what I'm...
Oh, I do. It's going to be good for GE. It's going to be good for General Dynamics. It's going to be good for Lockheed Martin Marietta.
And whoever's selling the $420 a gallon gas.
Oh, it's going to be great for them. It's going to be wonderful for the Saudis.
And then if he's sending 30,000 mercenaries along, you know what I mean? You always have to dig a little deeper. 30,000 troops, that's U.S., and then how many Blackwater or whatever other sort of private, You know what I mean?
Right.
Warlord, America.
Yeah, this ain't, no, that's 30,000, no. No, it's going to be a lot more than that by the time you're done with the unofficial numbers.
But we don't get to hear that in his lovely speech coming up at West Point.
Doesn't he give pretty speeches?
I'm over it. I just am sort of, you know, a bit frightened at how it's going to be prettied up, you know.
And, well, the other thing that just drives me crazy is that, and I alluded to some of this, in what I said, and that is that everybody who has an agenda that they are trying, a liberal or a progressive-based agenda that they have been trying to advance for almost a year now, needs to realize that when this happens, they can sit down and shut up too, because there ain't going to be no money for that. There's not going to be any money for human rights initiatives or environmental initiatives or health care initiatives. And the administration is not going to have time to focus on whether or not we should allow gays to serve openly in the military. Everything gets shut down because of this. And if there are organizations out there or groups of people saying, well, you know, this really isn't, this is not my issue. I'm more concerned about fill in the blank. They need a little cold glass of water thrown in their face, and then this is your issue. Because your issue ain't squat once this goes down.
Well, yeah, and I just, you know, I mean, I'll let you go, but I just can't help but think that this can't even be happening. It's so outrageous and so wrong-headed. Just economically, I'm confused. Because we're going to get a jobs report on Friday, right? Don't they come out every Friday?
I think you're right, yeah.
And it's just sort of, you know, what's going on? Foreclosures are, like, accelerating. All the indicators for just people living day to day is just way out of whack. And this is what he can devote his time to?
Beats the hell out of me.
That's all, and I don't mean to, you know, just make it all sound rhetorical.
Oh, I know, but
I really don't have the answers. I am sort of like.
Yes, you do.
Well, no, but it's just.
Yes, you do. Don't sell yourself short, Sandra. You do, and I do, and most of the people, I would guess 99% of the people listening to this program do have the answer, and the answer is get out of Afghanistan. Waste no time. Don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out of Afghanistan. Leave. Go and be gone and darken the doorway no more and spill not another pinprick's worth of blood on that soil that is American. Get out. Go. Leave. Be home. And that is the answer, and it's not Zen, and it doesn't require a Jedi mind trick, and it's not secret, and it just get out.
And it's just sort of like, you know, we looked at the elite, you know, crack up with the financial sector, and now they're just going to finish the job up with their military exploits. You know what I mean? Because this don't make no sense at all.
Yeah, where does the United States go to declare bankruptcy?
Well, that's that big carry tray I'm talking to you about.
Yeah. I know. Sandra, I thank you, and I appreciate your input. And, you know, sometimes in the face of madness like this, there's not much more to do than sit and scratch our heads and just wonder what in the hell is going through his.
Exactly. Okay, well, have a good evening.
All right, you take care.
Bye.
Bye now. From California, that is... our buddy Sandra, that would be Professor Sandra, and we will move on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
How you doing, brother?
I'm frustrated.
Ah, welcome to the club.
I live there. I live at the club. I have a little cot in the back of the club.
Any longer there, you'll be a stool, right?
they've already got me raking the leaves.
Yeah. All I'm saying is, I understand the frustration, but he needs to stay alive. Screw with the military industrial complex is dead.
I understand it. But you know what?
And
he signed up for it. You know, it's like a marriage, sickness and in health.
I am missing. And last week was a warning. I don't care what anyone, and you can say I'm a conspiracy theorist.
Whoa, hadn't considered that.
When that couple came, because come on, you, in your heart of hearts, you think if that was Bush on that party, you think that couple would have gotten through?
Not a chance.
And even if they did, they would be locked under the prison by now.
But, you know, yeah, because there were all kinds of things that were highly disturbing, like that statement, well, they got through the magnetometer, so they wasn't carrying no guns nor nothing.
Yeah, well, there are a bunch of silverware over there. They could have done some problems.
Well, never mind the silverware. Am I the only guy that gets the Cabela's catalog with the cool ceramic blades in it?
I guess so.
They don't set off metal detectors.
All I'm saying is, I think he just wants to stay alive. So, and the thing is, you gotta understand, who has that? I guess 35 or 1/3 of America who's like, no, you know what is going to be the boss of me. So he has to do this in baby steps.
I don't think there's that, Kevin. I'm sorry. I don't think there's any baby steps.
Or he has to tread on a. He has to walk on a razor.
But this is, I mean, this is a straight-up sellout.
Oh, you know, put it this way. You know what I say? As an African-American man, we all have our Uncle Tom moments. Even the best of us. Even Malcolm X had an Uncle Tom moment.
Man, that is a bitter pill I ain't going to go nowhere near.
But it's true. It's like Congressman Charles Rangel, when he got all in a hyper when what's his name from Venezuela called George Bush a jackass or whatever.
Well, apparently you've got one in agreement in our buddy Marty.
We all have our Uncle Tom moment.
He said, I guess I was one of the few who actually heard him say that he, Obama, considered Afghanistan to be the right war. No, I heard it too. And Marty says, you know, I'm not that surprised. I'm not even that upset because I knew he wasn't a peace president.
Yeah.
He said, and as Kevin indicated, he got a warning with the gate crashers, you know, anyway.
Yeah. We all have our Uncle Tom moment, and you just got to take it and follow it. Trust me, I've had a few Uncle Tom moments.
Well, you know what, and I think that phrase carries particular freight, Kevin. But if you are in the middle or the working class, whatever you prefer to call it,
yeah.
Everybody has that moment at some time or another in their lives.
Oh yeah.
When they are called upon to face dire consequences if they do not knuckle under.
Oh yeah, and you know we all have, regardless of color, when you have to yield to a higher authority, you're going to have to count.
And few among us there are who won't. It has become abundantly clear to me by the reading that I've been doing lately. And I think it's time for me to put the book down, too, just because I've started dreaming it, and that means I'll be, you know, no. Yeah, got to have a little peace sometime.
Yeah.
But it's abundantly clear to me that JFK died for his principles.
Oh, yeah.
There is absolutely no debate about the fact that Martin Luther King Jr. died for his principles. There is no doubt that Bobby Kennedy died for his principles. And even though people from his own faction killed him, there's no doubt to me that Malcolm X died for his principles.
Exactly.
And you know what? Maybe in, and you know, after they're dead, we say, oh, they were great men, but we forget to note, oh, they are great dead men.
Yeah.
And maybe it is that most of us in the human experience don't have that metal. When you know when the rubber meets the road, we say yes, boss, and we move on and we go do what we did and we eat our bread and we curse our bones.
Exactly, and the thing is, the reality is, very few people want to be a martyr. You know, here's a man. And
I don't think any of the people I just named wanted to be one.
Be a martyr, but they signed on and they knew what they had to do.
And they could not live with themselves being any other way than what they were.
Exactly. You know, and the fact of the matter is, Barack Obama probably said, look, man, I'm going to do whatever I can, but I have to go along to get along. I have two little girls. I have a wife. I don't come from money like the Kennedys.
Then you know what? And I'm going to say this, and I'll probably get letters from people saying, I ain't going to listen to you no more.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you've realized a year into your term, resign.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. You know, he should have known, and I agree with you 100%.
Go be a law professor. Live a quiet life. You know, I'm sorry that I constantly go back to ancient history, but you're kind of willing to go there with me because you talk about it too. There's that legend of Achilles. Who, before he signed on for the Trojan War, talked with his mama. And his mama told him, if you don't go to that war, you will live to be a ripe old age. You will have a lovely wife. You will have beautiful children. And you will be remembered by that wife and those children when you were gone, and you will be remembered by your grandchildren. But after a generation or two, you will be forgotten. If you go to the war, you will not come home, and you will be a name that will live throughout all of human existence. And Achilles chose to go to the war. Well, Barack Obama has just chosen to stay home, live to a ripe old age, and be forgotten. 200 years from now, if there is still a United States of America, he will be a Jeopardy question asked by Cyber Alex. Who was the first black president of America? And by then, maybe we will have had 15 or 16 of them. And, who was Martin Luther King, Cyber Alex? Oh, sorry. Ding. Who was Barack Obama? Yes, that's right. And that's the sad thing. I think Barack Obama has trivialized himself today.
I don't know. I still got to say, because, well, he's only a year in, you know. A lot can happen. Who knows?
Well, you know what? Maybe we roll the dice over there, the 30,000 get there, and all the Afghan warlords and all the Taliban go, well, shit, you're serious about it. You sent 30,000 more soldiers. Damn, I guess we'll just disband and sit down, come to the table and talk and sing Kumbaya and put together a constitution and start ordering color TV sets.
No, I don't think so.
But I'd say my odds of winning the lottery are a little better than the odds of that happening.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, I try to have some kind of faith.
Yeah, but you know how I am on doing faith.
I do
facts. I do the real world. And there is nothing right now, Kevin, in the real world that suggests to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard. I can't even bring myself to say it.
Yeah. I just, you know, but the thing is, I don't know. It's just one of those things where it's like, I know deep down, he's not like George, who's just a total prick. You know, this is a good, decent human being.
Yeah, but look where we are, Kevin. Okay, this went down today. Here we are. The whole world knows that Barack Obama is going to send 30,000 more of the flower of American youth into the now frozen meat grinder of Afghanistan. Okay, so naturally, Politico goes over to interview Dick Cheney about it.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't even write a story. They just transcribed what he said. No kidding. It was a 90-minute interview, and it was nothing but a transcription. Cheney said the president's agonizing about Afghanistan strategy has consequences for your forces in the field. Every time he delays, defers, debates, changes his position, it begins to raise questions. Is the commander-in-chief really behind what they've been asked to do? Here's a guy without much experience who campaigned against much of what we put in place and who now travels around the world apologizing. I think our adversaries, especially when that's preceded by a deep bow, see that as a sign of weakness.
Why doesn't Katie die already?
Because evil doesn't die. Evil doesn't go away until you drive a stake through its heart and dump its bones somewhere without access to the soil of the old country. Okay? No, that's... But honestly, this isn't going to let up. I'm not kidding. I don't have my threadbare purple velvet robe with the moon and stars and the magic eight ball with the crack in the face that always says answer hazy, ask again later. I don't have any of that on. But I know that 30,000 is going to be 30,000 too few for the right wing. And I know that if it was 60, it'd be 60,000 too few for the right wing. And if we sent 1 million, they'd want to send 2.
Exactly.
And that if we actually conquered, if we did what Eugene Finnerman was talking about with the ancient Greeks, and we actually colonized and set up outpost colonies of American exceptionalism in Afghanistan and built cities from the ground up, if we did that, then the right wing would say, well, see, it worked in Afghanistan, let's go do somebody else. There is no satisfying those bloodthirsty sons of bitches, Kevin.
You're absolutely not right.
There's no right answer for them. There is nothing that Barack Obama can do that will please them. So for the love of God, why doesn't he just do what his base sent him there to do and tell the right wing to go suck on a lemon?
Yeah. Well, what you just said, okay, right there, is probably what it is to work in corporate America if you're African-American with a college degree.
And this in from Sandra following up, she said, well, Uncle Tom needs to resign.
Yeah. Well, I just say, I give him, you know, being in, having some kind of experience being under a leadership role with a bunch of middle-aged white guys underneath me, that I give him, because I know what he's going through. I just know what he's going through.
But how much of a pass can that generate, Kevin?
It can, and the thing is, put it to you this way, I say this, a lesser man would have said, you know what, would have resigned. A lesser man would have resigned.
I mean, but, you know, let's, and I'm wondering, and this probably marks me as getting this wrong somehow or another, but I'm wondering how this is going to play in the black community.
It's not going to play. Well, you see, it depends on what segment of the black community, because I would say for the most part, the black community is, especially the African-American community, because, you know, I come from a different kind of black community.
Yeah, sure.
It's going to play, it's going to be like, well, you know, I think it's going to be what it is. They're going to back him because the reality is the African-American community, from my point of view, is not that different from the white conservative community.
So when this decision winds up in some young black man who had no choice but to go to the military because, you know, he's a smart guy, but, you know, no jobs. And no college.
Yeah.
And the military offers, well, son, all you got to do is go survive Afghanistan. You can come back and go to college. Pretty good deal, isn't it, son?
Well, yeah.
And he comes home in a box. Mm-hmm. And mama starts tearing at her hair and her clothing and weeping and wailing, as any mama would.
But Molly gets a $250,000 to $500,000 worth of insurance money.
But Mama's not going to look up at the White House and go, hope and change just did this.
Well, I don't know about all that. Because Mother doesn't think about the bigger picture and who's really making money off of this. Don't forget that insurance policy that he'll get. And all the benefits, and he gets to die, get a nice send-off in Arlington with the 21-gun salute. Trust me, I've seen this movie before.
I don't want to go to that movie no more.
Too many times and too close for my own good. And if you say something wrong about it, they'll be like, well, why don't you up and leave America? Which, you know, on my end, I'm about to do, God willing. you know, black America is very much like, you know, conservative white America. The only thing, they're just on two separate parties, because black America doesn't like the Jim Crow that, you know, conservative white America believes in. But, you know, a lot of times, from the outside looking in, you know, it's kind of like, hey, you know, ebony and ivory, they play together in perfect harmony.
Bitter pill.
Yeah, and that's just the cold hard reality. You know, it's just, you know, that black America is very conservative. Why do you think, you know, the most homophobic sectors of this country is African American?
No, well, no argument. You know, I can. It's. Oh wow, some talk show host, huh? Kevin, you say that you're getting ready, God willing, to bug out, and I that's no pejorative, okay? It's just a phrase. You're getting ready to leave. You're gonna get out of the country. And I understand the urge to do it. But at the same time, I can hear you wanting not to.
Yeah.
I can hear the ache in your voice at what it is that you feel has become of this country that drives you to such a decision.
You're absolutely hit the nail, because I love what America stands for. I especially love New York. You know, and it's a hurtful thing when you see your country defies every bit of your conscience. You know, and your thing of what's right and what's wrong. You know, I don't want my hand in anything that kills off brown people anymore. I don't want it.
Just done with it.
Yeah.
And not willing to participate.
Yeah. And like the late, great Timothy Leary said, you know, you have to tune in, then drop out. And, you know, that's what I really need to do at this point.
And I understand it. God knows I do. Yeah. Kevin, wonderful conversation. Thank you for offering. Thank you for offering the perspective. I do appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Bro. Bye.
Bye. Before we head back to the phones, a couple of emails, your thoughts. This from Reverbo. The last vestige of our legendary, read delusional, exceptionalism is on the battlefield. Though we haven't really seen proof of that for 65 years. When it comes to civic projects, forget it. This was supposed to be a new beginning. A purge of the vampires. And instead, it feels more like the end. I worked for the so-called change, Reverbo says. This is not easy for me to say. Subject line, we're not exceptional at home, though, are we? Signed, Reverbo, no shortage of criticism. And from Gail in Australia. She says, I've been sitting here reading old Kurt Vonnegut articles and interviews this morning. It's morning there, you know. And she offers a piece of Kurt Vonnegut from 2004. Vonnegut wrote, and this is so fitting because I know that Reverbo is also a student of Vonnegut, having sent some along from time to time. Vonnegut wrote in 2004, many years ago, I was so innocent, I still considered it possible that we could become the humane and reasonable America so many members of my generation used to dream of. We dreamed of such an America during the Great Depression, when there were no jobs. And then we fought, and often died, for that dream during the Second World War, when there was no peace. But I know now that there is not a chance in hell of America's becoming humane and reasonable. Because power corrupts us. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. Human beings are chimpanzees who get crazy drunk on power. By saying that our leaders are power-drunk chimpanzees, am I in danger of wrecking the morale of our soldiers fighting and dying in the Middle East? Their morale, like so many bodies, is already shot to pieces. They are being treated, as I never was, like toys a rich kid got for Christmas. Sigh. Gale. Missing. It seems that the great voices are we are found wanting for great voices to put real meat on the bones of what these tragic decisions actually mean. From Michael Moore. No, he didn't send this to me. He just published it to the internet and thought I'd share it with you if you haven't heard it. Dear President Obama, do you really want to be the new war president? If you go to West Point and announce that you are increasing rather than withdrawing the troops in Afghanistan, you are the new war president. Pure and simple. And with that, you will do the worst possible thing you could do. Destroy the hopes and dreams so many millions have placed in you. With just one speech tomorrow night, you will turn a multitude of young people who were the backbone of your campaign into disillusioned cynics. You will teach them what they've always heard is true, that all politicians are alike. I simply can't believe you're about to do what they say you are going to do. Please say it isn't so. It is not your job to do what the generals tell you to do. We are a civilian-run government. We tell the Joint Chiefs what to do, not the other way around. That's the way General Washington insisted it must be. That's what President Truman told General MacArthur when MacArthur wanted to invade China. You're fired, said Truman, and that was that. And you should have fired General McChrystal when he went to the press to preempt you, telling the press what you had to do. Let me be blunt. We love our kids in the armed forces, but we effing hate these generals. From Westmoreland in Vietnam to, yes, even Colin Powell for lying to the UN with his made-up drawings of WMD. He has since sought redemption. So now you feel backed into a corner. 30 years ago, this past Thursday, this past Thanksgiving, the Soviet generals had a cool idea. Let's invade Afghanistan! Well, that turned out to be the final nail in the USSR's coffin. There's a reason they don't call Afghanistan the Garden State, though they probably should, seeing how the corrupt President Karzai, whom we back, has his brother in the heroin trade raising poppies. Afghanistan's nickname is the Graveyard of Empires. If you don't believe it, give the British a call. I'd have you call Genghis Khan, but I lost his number. I do have Gorbachev's number, though. I'm sure he could give you an earful about the historic blunder you're about to commit. With our economic collapse still in full swing, and our precious young men and women being sacrificed on the altar of arrogance and greed, the breakdown of this great civilization we call America will head full throttle into oblivion if you become the war president. Empires never think the end is near until the end is here. Empires think that more evil will force the heathens to toe the line, and yet it never works. The heathens usually tear them to shreds. Choose carefully, President Obama. You of all people know that it doesn't have to be this way. You still have a little time to listen to your heart and your own clear thinking. You know that nothing good can come from sending more troops halfway around the world to a place neither you nor they understand, to achieve an objective that neither you nor they understand, in a country that does not want us there. You can feel it in your bones. I know you know that there are less than 100 Al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. 100,000 troops trying to crush 100 guys living in caves? Are you serious? Have you drunk Bush's Kool-Aid? I refuse to believe it.
Your potential decision to expand the war while saying that you're doing it so you can end the war will do more to set your legacy in stone than any of the great things you've said and done in your first year. One more throwing a bone from you to the Republicans, and the coalition of the hopeful and the hopeless may be gone. And this nation will be back in the hands of the haters quicker than you can shout teabag. Choose carefully, Mr. President. Your corporate backers are going to abandon you as soon as it is clear you are a one-term president and that the nation will be safely back in the hands of the usual idiots who do their bidding. That could be Wednesday morning. We the people still love you. We the people still have a sliver of hope. But we the people can't take it anymore. We can't take your caving in over and over. When we elected you to by a big, wide margin of millions to get in there and get the job done. What part of landslide victory don't you understand? Don't be deceived into thinking that sending a few more troops into Afghanistan will make a difference or earn you the respect of the haters. They will not stop until this country is torn asunder and every last dollar is extracted from the poor and soon to be poor. You could send a million troops over there and the crazy right still wouldn't be happy. You would still be the victim of their incessant venom on hate radio and television, because no matter what you do, you can't change the one thing about yourself that sends them over the edge. The haters were not the one who elected you, and they can't be won over by abandoning the rest of us. President Obama, it's time to come home. Ask your neighbors in Chicago and the parents of the young men and women doing the fighting and dying if they want more billions and more troops sent to Afghanistan. Do you think they will say, no, we don't need health care, we don't need jobs, we don't need homes? You go on ahead, Mr. President, and send our wealth and our sons and daughters overseas, because we don't need them either. What would Martin Luther King Jr. do? What would your grandmother do? Not send more poor people to kill other poor people who pose no threat to them. That's what they do. Not spend billions and trillions to wage war while American children are sleeping on the streets and standing in bread lines. All of us that voted and prayed for you and cried the night of your victory have endured an Orwellian hell of 8 years of crimes committed in our name. Torture, rendition, suspension of the Bill of Rights, invading nations who had not attacked us, blowing up neighborhoods that Saddam might be in, but never was, slaughtering wedding parties in Afghanistan. We watched as hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians were slaughtered, and tens of thousands of our brave young men and women were killed, maimed, or endured mental anguish, the full terror of which we scarcely know. When we elected you, we didn't expect miracles. We didn't even expect much change. But we expected some. We thought you would stop the madness. Stop the killing. Stop the insane idea that men with guns can reorganize a nation that doesn't even function as a nation and never, ever has. Stop. 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 For the sake of the lives of young Americans and Afghan civilians, stop. For the sake of your presidency, hope, and the future of our nation, stop. For God's sake, stop. For a few minutes more, we still have hope. Tomorrow, we shall see. The ball is in your court. You don't have to do this. You can be a profile in courage. You can be your mother's son. We're counting on you. Indeed. So, we are halfway through the program for the evening.
We will take a brief break and come back to your phone calls. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Direct dial is 304-658-3333. While there are a few moments left to have hope, let us have it. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. Jason Isbell in the 400 unit, however long. And that's just the name of the album, is Jason Isbell and the 400 unit. And if you don't own it,
I suggest you do. I listen to that song a lot. And let me just put it before we go to the phones and do a couple more emails. Let me just put kind of a coda on that. This is grim business we've been discussing for the last hour and 35 minutes. And it feels pretty weighty, and it feels pretty dark, and it feels pretty awful. And it's pretty sickening. But let me suggest another interpretation, if I may. Just as in discussing with Kevin the business about Oedipus, you know, there's always another lesson behind the lesson. The obvious lesson is there for the people that can only get obvious lessons. Subtext is there for those who seek it. And there is a subtext to this. Tonight we're free. This is a night of liberation. Tonight we are utterly and absolutely uncaptive. You're free. You are liberated. You don't have to swallow that bitter, vomitous taste in the back of your throat anymore and say, yeah, but, you know, he told us we'd have change. You don't have to do that anymore. For those of us persons of conscience, and I realize that we are a minority, but for those of us who are persons of conscience, we're free. We are utterly and absolutely free. No party binds us. No call to party loyalty binds us. We're free. We are absolutely free to follow our morals and follow our conscience and feel not one whit of misgiving about it. We're free. If Mr. Obama wants to escalate in Afghanistan, that's a decision that you and I were made no party to. We were not consulted. We were really, really not consulted. Never mind the fact that we put him in office. We were not consulted. We are now free. The marriage is annulled. It's over. You don't have to make excuses for him anymore. You don't have to say, well, but, when somebody who hates his guts starts talking. You can just look up and say, hey, he's a politician. What in God's name did I think he was? You don't have to say I was wrong. You don't have to say I was misguided or mistaken. You're just free. Take a deep breath, free American. Take a deep, sweet, long, invigorating breath. You're free. He makes no excuses to you, and you owe none to him. Wow, I can't wait to see the hate mail I get for this. But you're free. Any sense of obligation, any sense of contract with that administration is over. You're free. You can participate or sit out the election, and you know, you don't even have to look up and go, yeah, but what if the right wing gets in? Because you know, what we're doing tonight with Afghanistan is what the right wing would do. The right wing didn't get in. The right wing never left. You're free. Perhaps we can congregate around Congressman Kucinich or Congressman Grayson. Perhaps we can look to Bernie Sanders in the Senate to once in a while speak some common sense and human decency and dignity. But we're free. We're free. I have never said this. I have never contemplated this. But I'm going to tell you something that I'm strongly considering doing. Next time I'm across the river, I may just slip into the county courthouse and change my registration. Change it to independent. That means I get to vote in anybody's primary I want to. We're free. And in this case, freedom is something more than nothing left to lose. To be free to walk in the sunshine of one's own clear conscience. If one has the moral fiber to do it, is one of the greatest things that a human being can ever experience. And we can learn together if you want. I mean, I'll be happy to participate in the discussion of what it means and how we go about being it. Because there's more than putting flowers in your hair and dancing in the yard, naked or otherwise. You don't want me dancing naked in the yard, trust me. Not even dead dark cloud cover and no moon. You don't want it. But we can determine what that freedom means. And we can live that way. And we can speak our consciences and speak our minds and not give a rat's ass what some member of some administration thinks, because we are free. A little follow-up to Gail's, now we've got dueling Vonnegut quotes. Reverbo offers from Dead Eye Dick, 1982, quote, "That is my principal objection to life. I think it is too easy when alive to make perfectly horrible mistakes." Then this, says Reverbo, "You want to know something? We're still in the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages. They haven't ended yet." Reverbo adds, "Kurt Vonnegut, born 11 November, Armistice Day, 1922, died April of 2007. He had a few things to say about war, as I recall. I've wished he could have lived to see the election of 2008 and the progress that was promised, and that people like Vonnegut were waiting for their whole lives. Now I'm not so sure. How many more disappointments could the old guy take? How many more can we take?" From Marty, "I'm not sure as what is bothering me more. Once again, I knew what Obama would be, corporate, and what he wouldn't be, peace. Typically, the first black to achieve anything becomes just a tool of whatever the powers pulling the strings want, meaning we'd still be here with Hillary, only on a different day. The exception, of course, is the late Thurgood Marshall. Clarence Thomas actually acts like he's the first black on the Supreme Court. Now, back to my subject, I'm not certain what's bothering me more, the fact that Obama's ordering 30,000 or so more troops to Afghanistan, or the fact that he felt the need to go to a military academy to make the announcement." Just a bloody photo op. Bloody indeed. We will go to, I think, coverage of the speech here in about 18 minutes, but in the time remaining, let us go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Let's stoke up that email some more, because I have some stuff to say about this. But before I do, Bob, did you ever get a chance to watch that Evil Bee video?
No.
Someone needs to send it to you. Every single little intricacy in that video, it is so relevant to what we're speaking of right now. And I can say it like this. The whole video is an entire multi-layered cipher, and I don't care who you are listening to this. You can be the most brilliant person in the world. You will not get all of it, even if you see it 20 times. That's how amazing this thing is. So, if people want to check it out, type in Evil Bee at YouTube. You'll be in for a shock. I think it was on the front page of the the Head On Radio Network started one time anyway.
I'll try to go. You know, and I don't make excuses, David. It's just there's a lot of demands on my time, and
yeah,
I don't get the time to watch half the stuff I'd like to.
I saw
Charlie the Unicorn for the first time over the weekend because Margie came in and insisted that I watch it, and that was a delightful little giggle. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I don't think I've heard that one, though.
Yeah, just Charlie the Unicorn. Go watch them. There's three of them. It's just silly as shit. Nice little moment of escape.
Right. Well, my feelings on this are a bit different. I remember I was telling someone the other day, or I was telling this to my my dad. I said, America deserves what it gets. And the question I pose to you, Bob, is, what does America deserve?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that I'm necessarily down with your premise, because my children, my grandchildren don't deserve some evil fate to befall them because an evil decision was made in the White House in Washington, D.C. They don't deserve that, but it's damn well freight training right at them.
Yeah, I know.
But they don't deserve it. People of good conscience, people of solid moral stature don't deserve losing jobs or being bankrupted by illness or crushed by disease or tormented by insurance companies, but it's damn sure what they're getting. They don't deserve it. You know, that's why I raised the issue of Oedipus. You know, the plague struck Thebes. It didn't strike Oedipus. It was people who were totally innocent who were being struck dead in the streets by plague. All because of something that another guy did that he didn't even know he was doing. And that's the lesson of that piece of ancient Greek genius. It's not don't screw your mama and murder your daddy. That's easy. Any fool can figure that out. The lesson of that piece of ancient Greek tragedy is that what is done without even fully realizing the consequences is a price that is paid not by the person who makes the decision by God, but by the people who are innocent of it.
Well, you know, for those people who decided to... I'll give you a quote to Obama, the people who were rolling with him. He did say, you guys make a pretty good photo op. You guys can go look that one up. He actually said that to when the troops were standing right next to him.
Look, I know. You know, Marty's absolutely correct. He campaigned on the idea that Afghanistan is the right war. When, in fact, anybody with an ounce of common sense understands that there isn't a right war. There are only wars you choose to fight and wars that you are forced to fight. And in the case of Afghanistan and Iraq, those are both wars that the United States chose to fight. We were forced to fight the Second World War.
The argument that someone would make for that is...
Is that Afghanistan hit us first?
No, they won't say that. It says, when you say what it is that you're saying... most likely people come back with, and they know it's short term, but it's better to live in the myth than going insane for these people. That's why I say most of the people who agree with war aren't, and this is where we part company a bit, because I don't think Republicans and a lot of the conservatives are evil. I see them as psychologically dysfunctional.
Yeah, but I don't disagree with you, David, but the psychological dysfunction leads to evil conduct.
I understand that.
You know, Jeffrey Dahmer had a broken brain, but he was still putting people in his freezer and eating them later. And that's evil.
I understand that, but, I mean, the problem is that there needs to be a myth somewhere. If everything else is rigged and it's a joke... Some people are just going to cling to the patriotic myth of war, and that's what we teach our kids.
But Baron,
not you.
No. But bear in mind, David, that's what makes this upcoming decision so absolutely heinous is the fact that upwards of 80% of the United States doesn't want to be there. You know, that's more people than elected Barack Obama. That includes some Republicans. I mean, my God, there's a guy named Jason Chaffetz.
Yeah.
Okay, he looks like an Osmond. He's a congressman from Utah. You know, Utah. For God's sakes, Utah. And yesterday, he said to Politico, he said, so much of this is easy, black and white, but Afghanistan is very different and very difficult. I differ with him on that. He said, I can take pot shots at Acorn all day long and I'm good at it, but even though I am probably going against where the party is on this traditionally, I just think we need to stand up and support the notion that it's time to bring our soldiers home. And that's a Republican from Utah.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Bob, but I mean, no matter what we think of okay, say we do bring these soldiers home, I'm as cynical as the most cynical person you can find, and I know they'll just start another war and they'll make it even bigger so they won't go home.
You know what? That's one of the pieces of unappreciated genius of Bill Clinton. Because that crowd over there needled at him and needled at him and needled at him, trying to, you know, whether it was the coal or the aspirin factory in the Sudan, the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, they did everything in their power to get Bill Clinton to take their bait and start a war.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Clinton just wouldn't swallow the hook. Now, George W. Bush, he's a simpleton. It was like for Osama bin Laden to get him into a war in Afghanistan and Iraq was like taking falafel from a baby.
Right.
And sadly, it appears that the same is the case of Barack Obama for different reasons.
Well,
I mean, and again, you know, I have to reemphasize. If this was a 52-48 split, and the 52 wanted to come home and the 48 wanted to stay, or the 48 wanted to come home and the 52 wanted to stay, whatever. I think I just screwed up. Then you could make a case for Barack Obama doing some proverbial baby splitting, which is apparently what he's attempting to do tonight. But we are talking about an overwhelming majority of America that wants nothing to do. Now, granted, there are various political reasons for wanting nothing to do. I'm sure that the minute that Jason Chaffetz, being as how he's a Republican, that if he got his way, his next speech on the floor was, well, we had to leave Afghanistan because Barack Obama's a big old chicken shit loser.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not some naive. I understand this, but America doesn't want this, and it is being forced on us anyway.
That is what
I think more than anything else calls this decision into profound question.
Well, I think that's part of the problem with our country as a whole, is we don't really have a voice for the people. We have a pretend voice. We have an imaginary voice. But we don't have a voice for the people, and the Democrats aren't a voice for clearly. For God's sakes, they're never going to be our voice, people. It doesn't matter how many people you turn around; they're always going to find a way to screw us over, even worse than before. And that's why this is a lesson we can all learn from. And it's like you said, we're free, but. What it comes down to is the fact that, let's put it this way, because I haven't heard anyone say this. Obama never served in the military, people. I remember we said that about Cheney, and we said that about Bush. So guess what? We have a chicken hawk in office. He's never been on the battlefield, and that's the problem with our leaders. All of our leaders, they've never been on the battlefield. They've never experienced the blood. They've never experienced the murder, the genocide, the rape, they've never experienced. And I don't care how smart you think Obama is. He never frigging experienced it. It's over. He's a chicken hawk, and this just basically puts it out right there in the open. He's just like Bush in that regards, just like Cheney in that regards.
Well, you know, all I can say is if he wants to buy it, we need to make sure that he owns it. You know, it's that phony story of Colin Powell and the Pottery Barn rule.
Well, as I said, Bob, that's why I said when I was talking to you before, I said you never ever trust a president, a leader who has never been in military or combat. They'll always screw you over. They'll always F you over.
Nah, see, but I don't get down with that. No, because it's the guys who have been in combat, and it's the guys who have a military background. I mean, a lot of ours have, but, you know, Thomas Jefferson? Really? Screwed us over? John Adams? James Madison? I mean, you know, Andrew Jackson was a general, and he committed an actual genocide.
There wasn't a presence of a war machine behind us this gigantic that we've seen before. That's the problem. And that's why we need someone who has been in the military.
You know, Abraham, there was a war machine by the time Abraham Lincoln was president, and his service was about, you know, it wasn't the same level of cowardice. It wasn't cowardice at all, but it was about the same duration as that of George W. Bush. But he managed to get in and out of the Civil War. Then he got wasted. Ulysses S. Grant was a plum general, and Ulysses S. Grant then went on to run the single most corrupt administration in American history until Warren Gamaliel Harding took that award, until Richard Nixon took that award, until Ronald Reagan took that award, until George W. Bush absolutely ran out of the building with it.
I would say the war machine now is incredibly more subliminal, more entrenched, and that is why we can't have it any other way. As sad as that is, otherwise we're going to still be at this point every single time.
I think what you're describing, David, is the down spiral into empire. Because there is a model for this, and that is empire, where the leader becomes the general who can marshal the greatest amount of support. And Lord knows the first two or three centuries of the current era were rife with that. But let me try to get one more phone call in here before we go to the broadcast feed. I appreciate your thoughts, David. I really, really do. I'm about half and half with you.
All right.
You take care.
Bye.
From Maine, that is David, and let's see if this long-suffering person has held on. Nope. Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Quick email. Kim writes in from Manhattan. Bob, I'm too chicken to call in, so I decided to write. Okay, Kim, we got to talk. We've never lost a caller yet. It's okay. Phone number, don't ever be afraid to call in. The first-time callers absolutely make my night. But anyway, Kim says, I have to tell you, your conversation with Kevin really pissed me off. I usually really enjoy his calls, but hearing him give a pass to Obama tonight really angered me. If Obama is so concerned about staying alive, and if he feels that he is being forced to make decisions that he doesn't believe in, and if he has any integrity left, then he should resign tonight. I have finally reached my limit of granting Obama absolution. I backed Obama strongly when he was a candidate, but he has time and again disappointed me, and to make this speech in West Point is as cynical as any move Bush ever made. It just disgusts me. Sorry about ranting, Bob. Oh, Kim, if you think that's ranting. Sorry about ranting, Bob, and I don't mean to be rough on Kevin, but I just had to. I love your show, Kim from Manhattan. Gosh, we think we're being rough on each other, and it's about as... No, that's just honesty. That's not being rough on any. I don't even think Kevin would think that anybody was being rough on him that way. And Cindy writes in from the Great Northwest saying, we don't deserve it. Talking about the question of, you know, what do we deserve? We don't deserve it, Cindy says. We don't deserve this any more than the Jews deserved Hitler. And that's the thing. Workaday human beings don't deserve half of the misery that they are, that is forced upon them. I offer the following. Naturally, the common people don't want war. But after all, it is the leaders of a country who determine the policy. And it is always a simple matter to drag people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. This is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country. I'm just going to let that statement stand on its own. Most of you know from whence it comes, but I'm not going to give the name of who said it. But what is there in that statement with which to argue? Not much. So when we come back, we will go to the feed, and I will probably have periodic hissy fits during the speech. When we come back, we will go to the feed, you and I, free, you and I, liberated, you and I, we'll go to the feed, and we will see what gets said in this really big, good speech. You know? Yeah. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
I hope somebody's called, stay soon, it's getting hard to find a place to root. get along without the rest of me. It wouldn't matter if they did.
Preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
We now join an American tragedy already in progress.
Narrowly defined as disrupting, dismantling, and defeating Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, and pledged to better coordinate our military and civilian efforts. Since then, we've made progress on some important objectives. High-ranking Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders have been killed, and we've stepped up the pressure on Al-Qaeda worldwide. In Pakistan, that nation's army has gone on its largest offensive in years. In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election. And although it was marred by fraud, that election produced a government that is consistent with Afghanistan's laws and constitution. Yet huge challenges remain. Afghanistan is not lost, but for several years it has moved backwards. There's no imminent threat of the government being overthrown, but the Taliban has gained momentum. Al-Qaeda has not reemerged in Afghanistan in the same numbers as before 9/11, but they retain their safe havens along the border. And our forces lack the full support they need to effectively train and partner with Afghan security forces and better secure the population. Our new commander in Afghanistan, General McChrystal, has reported that the security situation is more serious than he anticipated. In short, the status quo is not sustainable. As cadets, you volunteer for service during this time of danger. Some of you fought in Afghanistan. Some of you will deploy there. As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined and worthy of your service. And that's why, after the Afghan voting was completed, I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy. Now, let me be clear. There has never been an option before me that called for troop deployments before 2010. So there has been no delay or denial of resources necessary for the conduct of the war during this review period. Instead, the review has allowed me to ask the hard questions and to explore all the different options, along with my national security team, our military and civilian leadership in Afghanistan, and our key partners. And given the stakes involved, I owed the American people and our troops no less. This review is now complete. And as Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan. I do not make this decision lightly. I opposed the war in Iraq precisely because I believe that we must exercise restraint in the use of military force and always consider the long-term consequences of our actions. We have been at war now for 8 years, at enormous cost in lives and resources. Years of debate over Iraq and terrorism have left our unity on national security issues in tatters and created a highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this effort. And having just experienced the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the American people are understandably focused on rebuilding our economy and putting people to work here at home. Most of all, I know that this decision asks even more of you, a military that, along with your families, has already borne the heaviest of all burdens. As President, I have signed a letter of condolence to the family of each American who gives their life in these wars. I have read the letters from the parents and spouses.
Just not the ones driven to suicide by the wars, by the way.
Wounded warriors at Walter Reed. I've traveled to Dover to meet the flag-draped caskets of 18 Americans returning home to their final resting place. I see firsthand the terrible wages of war. If I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan, I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow. So no, I do not make this decision lightly. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is the epicenter of violent extremism practiced by Al-Qaeda. It is from here that we were attacked on 9/11, and it is from here that new attacks are being plotted as I speak. This is no idle danger, no hypothetical threat. In the last few months alone, we have apprehended extremists within our borders who were sent here from the border region of Afghanistan and Pakistan to commit new acts of terror. And this danger will only grow if the region slides backwards and Al-Qaeda can operate with impunity. We must keep the pressure on Al-Qaeda, and to do that, we must increase the stability and capacity of our partners in the region. Of course, this burden is not ours alone to bear. This is not just America's war. Since 9/11, Al-Qaeda's safe havens have been the source of attacks against London and Amman and Bali. The people and governments of both Afghanistan and Pakistan are in danger. And the stakes are even higher within a nuclear-armed Pakistan because we know that Al-Qaeda and other extremists seek nuclear weapons, and we have every reason to believe that they would use them. These facts compel us to act along with our friends and allies. Our overarching goal remains the same, to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we will pursue the following objectives within Afghanistan. We must deny al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future. We will meet these objectives in three ways. First, we will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010, the fastest possible pace, so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers. They'll increase our ability to train competent Afghan security forces and to partner with them so that more Afghans can get into the fight. And they will help create the conditions for the United States to transfer responsibility to the Afghans. Because this is an international effort, I've asked that our commitment be joined by contributions from our allies. Some have already provided additional troops, and we're confident that there will be further contributions in the days and weeks ahead. Our friends have fought and bled and died alongside us in Afghanistan. And now we must come together to end this war successfully. For what's at stake is not simply a test of NATO's credibility. What's at stake is the security of our allies and the common security of the world. Now, taken together, these additional American and international troops will allow us to accelerate handing over responsibility to Afghan forces and allow us to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. Just as we have done in Iraq, we will execute this transition responsibly, taking into account conditions on the ground. We'll continue to advise and assist Afghanistan's security forces to ensure that they can succeed over the long haul. But it will be clear to the Afghan government, and more importantly to the Afghan people, that they will ultimately be responsible for their own country. Second, we will work with our partners, the United Nations, and the Afghan people to pursue a more effective civilian strategy so that the government can take advantage of improved security. This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over. President Karzai's inauguration speech sent the right message about moving in a new direction. And going forward, we will be clear about what we expect from those who receive our assistance. We'll support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable. And we will also focus our assistance in areas such as agriculture that can make an immediate impact in the lives of the Afghan people. Now, the people of Afghanistan have endured violence for decades. They've been confronted with occupation by the Soviet Union and then by foreign al-Qaeda fighters who used Afghan land for their own purposes. So tonight, I want the Afghan people to understand. America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering. We have no interest in occupying your country. We will support efforts by the Afghan government to open the door to those Taliban who abandon violence and respect the human rights of their fellow citizens. And we will seek a partnership with Afghanistan grounded in mutual respect, to isolate those who destroy, to strengthen those who build, to hasten the day when our troops will leave, and to forge a lasting friendship in which America is your partner and never your patron. Third, we will act with the full recognition that our success in Afghanistan is inextricably linked to our partnership with Pakistan. We're in Afghanistan to prevent a cancer from once again spreading through that country. But this same cancer has also taken root in the border region of Pakistan. And that's why we need a strategy that works on both sides of the border. In the past, There have been those in Pakistan who have argued that the struggle against extremism is not their fight, and that Pakistan is better off doing little or seeking accommodation with those who use violence. But in recent years, as innocents have been killed from Karachi to Islamabad, it has become clear that it is the Pakistani people who are the most endangered by extremism. Public opinion has turned. The Pakistani army has waged an offensive in Swat in South Waziristan. And there is no doubt that the United States and Pakistan share a common enemy. In the past, we too often defined our relationship with Pakistan narrowly. And those days are over. Moving forward, we are committed to a partnership with Pakistan that is built on a foundation of mutual interest, mutual respect, and mutual trust. We will strengthen Pakistan's capacity to target those groups that threaten our countries and have made it clear that we cannot tolerate a safe haven for terrorists whose location is known and whose intentions are clear. America is also providing substantial resources to support Pakistan's democracy and development. We are the largest international supporter for those Pakistanis displaced by the fighting. And going forward, the Pakistan people must know America will remain a strong supporter of Pakistan's security and prosperity long after the guns have fallen silent, so that the great potential of its people can be unleashed. These are the three core elements of our strategy: a military effort to create the conditions for a transition, a civilian surge that reinforces positive action, and an effective partnership with Pakistan. Now, I recognize there are a range of concerns about our approach, so let me briefly address a few of the more prominent arguments that I've heard, and which I take very seriously. First, there are those who suggest that Afghanistan is another Vietnam. They argue that it cannot be stabilized, and we're better off cutting our losses and rapidly withdrawing. I believe this argument depends on a false reading of history. Unlike Vietnam, we are joined by a broad coalition of 43 nations that recognizes the legitimacy of our action. Unlike Vietnam, we are not facing a broad-based popular insurgency. And most importantly, unlike Vietnam, the American people were viciously attacked from Afghanistan and remain a target for those same extremists who are plotting along its border. To abandon this area now and to rely only on efforts against al-Qaeda from a distance would significantly hamper our ability to keep the pressure on al-Qaeda and create an unacceptable risk of additional attacks on our homeland and our allies. Second, there are those who acknowledge that we can't leave Afghanistan in its current state, but suggest that we go forward with the troops that we already have. But this would simply maintain a status quo in which we muddle through and permit a slow deterioration of conditions there. It would ultimately prove more costly and prolong our stay in Afghanistan, because we would never be able to generate the conditions needed to train Afghan security forces and give them the space to take over. Finally, there are those who oppose identifying a time frame for our transition to Afghan responsibility. Indeed, some call for a more dramatic and open-ended escalation of our war effort, one that would commit us to a nation-building project of up to a decade. I reject this course because it sets goals that are beyond what can be achieved at a reasonable cost and what we need to achieve to secure our interests. Furthermore, the absence of a time frame for transition would deny us any sense of urgency in working with the Afghan government. It must be clear that Afghans will have to take responsibility for their security, and that America has no interest in fighting an endless war in Afghanistan. As president, I refuse to set goals that go beyond our responsibility, our means, or our interests. And I must weigh all of the challenges that our nation faces. I don't have the luxury of committing to just one. Indeed, I'm mindful of the words of President Eisenhower, who, in discussing our national security, said, Each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Over the past several years, we have lost that balance. We failed to appreciate the connection between our Too many of our neighbors and friends are out of work and struggle. Too many Americans are worried about the future facing our children. Meanwhile, competition within the global economy has grown more fierce. So we can't simply afford to ignore the price of these wars. All told, by the time I took office, the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan approached $1 trillion. Going forward, I am committed to addressing these costs openly and honestly. Our new approach in Afghanistan is likely to cost us roughly $30 billion for the military this year. And I'll work closely with Congress to address these costs as we work to bring down our deficit. But as we end the war in Iraq and transition to Afghan responsibility, we must rebuild our strength here at home. Our prosperity provides a foundation for our power. It pays for our military, it underwrites our diplomacy, it taps the potential of our people and allows investment in new industry, and it will allow us to compete in this century as successfully as we did in the last. That's why our troop commitment in Afghanistan cannot be open-ended, because the nation that I'm most interested in building is our own. Now, let me be clear. None of this will be easy. The struggle against violent extremism will not be finished quickly, and it extends well beyond Afghanistan and Pakistan. It will be an enduring test of our free society and our leadership in the world. And unlike the great power conflicts and clear lines of division that defined the 20th century, our effort will involve disorderly regions, failed states, diffuse enemies. So as a result, America will have to show our strength in the way that we end wars and prevent conflict, not just how we wage wars. We'll have to be nimble and precise in our use of military power. Where Al-Qaeda and its allies attempt to establish a foothold, whether in Somalia or Yemen or elsewhere, they must be confronted by growing pressure and strong partnerships. And we can't count on military might alone. We have to invest in our homeland security because we can't capture or kill every violent extremist abroad. We have to improve and better coordinate our intelligence so that we stay one step ahead of shadowy networks. We will have to take away the tools of mass destruction. And that's why I've made it a central pillar of my foreign policy to secure loose nuclear materials from terrorists, to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, and to pursue the goal of a world without them. Because every nation must understand that true security will never come from an endless race for ever more destructive weapons. True security will come for those who reject them. We'll have to use diplomacy, because no one nation can meet the challenges of an interconnected world acting alone. I've spent this year renewing our alliances and forging new partnerships. And we have forged a new beginning between America and the Muslim world, one that recognizes our mutual interest in breaking a cycle of conflict and that promises a future in which those who kill innocents are isolated by those who stand up for peace and prosperity and human dignity. And finally, we must draw on the strength of our values. For the challenges that we face may have changed, but the things that we believe in must not. That's why we must promote our values by living them at home, which is why I have prohibited torture and will close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. And we must make it clear to every man, woman, and child around the world who lives under the dark cloud of tyranny that America will speak out on behalf of their human rights and tend to the light of freedom and justice and opportunity and respect for the dignity of all peoples. That is who we are. That is the source, the moral source of America's authority. Since the days of Franklin Roosevelt and the service and sacrifice of our grandparents and great-grandparents, our country has borne a special burden in global affairs. We have spilled American blood in many countries on multiple continents. We have spent our revenue to help others rebuild from rubble and develop their own economies. We have joined with others to develop an architecture of institutions from the United Nations to NATO to the World Bank that provide for the common security and prosperity of human beings. We have not always been thanked for these efforts, and we have at times made mistakes. But more than any other nation, the United States of America has underwritten global security for over six decades, a time that for all its problems has seen walls come down and markets open and billions lifted from poverty, unparalleled scientific progress and advancing frontiers of human liberty. For unlike the great powers of old, we have not sought world domination. Our union was founded in resistance to oppression. We do not seek to occupy other nations. We will not claim another nation's resources or target other peoples because their faith or ethnicity is different from ours. What we have fought for, what we continue to fight for, is a better future for our children and grandchildren, and we believe that their lives will be better if other people's children and grandchildren can live in freedom and access opportunity. As a country, we're not as young and perhaps not as innocent as we were when Roosevelt was president. Yet we are still heirs to a noble struggle for freedom. And now we must summon all of our might and moral suasion to meet the challenges of a new age. In the end, our security and leadership does not come solely from the strength of our arms. It derives from our people, from the workers and businesses who will rebuild our economy, from the entrepreneurs and researchers who will pioneer new industries, from the teachers that will educate our children, and the service of those who work in our communities at home, from the diplomats and Peace Corps volunteers who spread hope abroad, and from the men and women in uniform who are part of an unbroken line of sacrifice that has made government of the people, by the people, and for the people a reality on this earth. This vast and diverse citizenry will not always agree on every issue, nor should we. But I also know that we as a country cannot sustain our leadership nor navigate the momentous challenges of our time if we allow ourselves to be split asunder by the same rancor and cynicism and partisanship that has in recent times poisoned our national discourse. It's easy to forget that when this war began, we were united, bound together by the fresh memory of a horrific attack and by the determination to defend our homeland and the values we hold dear. I refuse to accept the notion that we cannot summon that unity again. I believe with every fiber of my being that we, as Americans, can still come together behind a common purpose. For our values are not simply words written into parchment. They are a creed that calls us together, and that has carried us through the darkest of storms as one nation, as one people. America, we are passing through a time of great trial. And the message that we send in the midst of these storms must be clear, that our cause is just, our resolve unwavering. We will go forward with the confidence that right makes might, and with the commitment to forge an America that is safer, a world that is more secure, and a future that represents not the deepest of fears, but the highest of hopes. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Man, don't he give a pretty speech. I mean, that's after 8 long, tormented, tortured years of the speechifying of George W. Bush. Isn't that just some of the best speechifying you ever heard in your in all your days? God Almighty. Kind of hoping it might last till 9. But, you know, they may be on the verge of receiving commissions in the United States military, but they are still no older than 22, and attention span is not their long suit. Couple of emails. Email slugged at doing the numbers from Reverbo. Let's see. Spend trillions in military operations tracking down a stateless bunch of a relatively few religious gangsters, or decide the American people are too big to fail, over 300 million, and pony up for them. Is this a rhetorical question? Shall we open this up to the panel? Or is everybody clear on our course? Good. We attack at dawn. I think you and me got told to sit down and shut the up. Who gives up what you think in that speech? Did you catch the history reference? I believe this is a false reading of history. Although, interestingly, President Obama referred only to the comparison between Afghanistan and Vietnam. He didn't quite get around to a comparison between Afghanistan and Afghanistan. Because that's the comparison. I will grant that Vietnam and Afghanistan may in large part be apples and oranges. There's no Cold War. And Vietnam was born in the Cold War. It's true. They're not the same. But what you have to get down and do is compare historically Afghanistan to Afghanistan to Afghanistan to Afghanistan to Afghanistan. And oddly enough, for all intents and purposes, and you may recall Eugene's remarks from the beginning of the program, Afghanistan always wins. Always. The Medes were there. There are no more Medes. The Persians were there. They're there no more. Genghis Khan was there. He's there no longer. The Russians were there. They're not there anymore. The British were there. They're not there anymore. We're there now, and someday we won't be there anymore, and the Afghans will remain, and we will have taken a severe ass-beating in an attempt to teach us the lesson that apparently Afghanistan was placed on the planet to teach. Those of you familiar with Frank Herbert will remember the line, Dune was created to test the faithful. Afghanistan was created to teach fools. I've got a lot of quotes here to go through. Maybe we'll go through them tomorrow night, if there's a program tomorrow night. I may have to be away from the microphone. I'm not entirely certain.
little email exchange from David in Tennessee that begins, 20 minutes into the speech and all that Obama is saying is wishful thinking, said well. His house is built on sand, if not silt. David then adds, it occurs to me that when he first desired election, when he was calling all his own shots, when Barack Hussein Obama offered himself up for election, he got his ass kicked badly. A 60s radical, a man that knew where he spoke, whereof he spoke, a man that pulled some hard time, one Bobby Seale told a congressional district on the south side of Chicago, boy, ain't got shit he can do for you. Ain't I done enough to keep my seat and do more? Who you gonna trust? David says, I rest my case. Trust the man that's been in the street. Barack was revealed some 15 years ago. From Cindy, what it was like listening to President Obama tonight, I was fuming. As my blood pressure raised and his speech became too long-winded, I turned on Malcolm in the Middle and waited for the horn to come back on air. I can't vote for this guy again. And yeah, as Cindy notes, he went on and on about our allies. What allies? I heard Germany's pulling out, England may too, other nations want this war in Afghanistan to end. Why didn't he name the so-called coalition of 48 nations? Is he talking about our American states? Just wondering. But the fact of the matter is, one thing arises out of this speech, and like I said, I've got notes. There was a good bit of Al-Qaeda talk, a lot of Taliban talk. Oddly enough, not a word about the problems that we face with the warlords who are shipping, even as we speak, branded. They are so brazen in it, they brand name their bricks. Are shipping heroin around the world as quickly as they can. He said it was from here that we were attacked on 9/11. He said it standing on a stage in West Point, New York. Now, you know how I feel about getting into that. But I will remind that on that same stage, roughly 3 months and a day before the September 11th attacks, Paul Wolfowitz delivered the commencement address at West Point in 2001, June 6th, I do believe. And he told the assembled graduating cadets from that same stage, in that same hall perhaps, I don't know, maybe in the football stadium. He said, I cannot tell you what is coming. I can only tell you to be prepared to be surprised. But overall, the one thing that I come away from this speech with, after being told that I'm a moron, because I don't know history, the one thing that I come away with is that this was not a speech about Afghanistan. What did we hear in the program before the speech started? They'll end one and start another. This was not a speech about Afghanistan, because practically every time that President Obama said Afghanistan, he added, and Pakistan. This was a speech about Pakistan. Really? Really? Hey, I said we'd be out of Afghanistan by 2011. I didn't say they were coming home. We're going to Pakistan. Sunshine, sit down and strap in. Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss.
hide your babies. Because the meat grinder is going to be churning for a long, long, long time. It may be that the meat grinder will churn until there is no more flesh and blood and bones to put in it, and no more money to power it. The only thing we can hope to be is awake in the nightmare. I hope you don't think me too dramatic. I'm only trying to give voice to what I've so often heard from you. And I'm only trying to give my honest assessment of where we stand. And we stand looking into the abyss. And the abyss has its binoculars out, and it's staring back. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
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 Yeah.
Hey, it's Brian from New Hampshire.
Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, I just want to say, what is that old song, House Built on a Weak Foundation? It has everything to do with the Obama speech. Our policy in regarding Afghanistan and our whole September 11th attacks, post-September 11th attacks policy is built on a foundation of lies. Those planes alone, they could never have brought down those two steel towers, and the World Trade Center 7 as well was brought down by a controlled demolition. It could only have been brought down by thermite, high-powered military explosives that were set there by the people that actually worked there weeks before, just after this guy Silverstein bought it July 2001, the Twin Towers and the rest of the Trade Center. He ends up making $8 billion from the insurance from a $14 million investment. This is what it's built on, and it's built on the mass murder of 3,000 Americans. We were told to stand down our NORAD and our air defenses and our national defense on September 11, 2001, when for between June of 2000 right up to September 11th, something like over 167 airplanes, errant airplanes, were off course, or your transponder went off for just within 5 minutes, within less than 10 minutes in every case, they were intercepted. And yet on September 11th, four jumbo jets control the skies for 2 full hours, and they let these people continue to get away with it. And like they just came out with the Senate hearing, Bob, where the news was there, and it shouldn't have been about Tiger Woods and who he's bopping or who he's fooling around with or what kind of or some little car accident or something. That it should have been about what the Senate Foreign Policy Committee found, that Donald Rumsfeld, he specifically ordered that allowed them at the Battle of Tora Bora in December 2001, that these specific...
To get away. Yeah, we talked about it last night on the show. Absolutely.
The Al-Qaeda leaders, including Osama bin Laden and many other valuable leaders to that terrorist organization, get away to Pakistan. And the fact is that those same people that Rumsfeld allowed to get away are directly responsible for the July 7th, 2005 London transit train and bus bombings that up to date, the casualty figure is over 70 dead and hundreds of wounded, and people will never be the same after you go through any kind of terrorist attack like that, whether you're in Baghdad or London or Belfast or...
Well,
or
Brian,
they're playing on our fears, Bob, and they're playing...
Well, they're not playing on mine, they're not playing on mine because I'm not afraid.
We're living a lie as a nation, though. The September 11th attacks.
I got to say, in the context of the discussion this evening, I am not interested in 9/11.
That's what he's using to base this war.
Right. He stood there
in Afghanistan.
Brian, he stood there and he said, "People forget that after 9/11 we were united." You know, that was a lie, because we were not united when the Taliban offered up Osama bin Laden, and George Bush rejected it. When they said, "We will give him to the Hague and he can be tried for what he has done," and George Bush said, "Not good enough. Let the bombs begin to fall." I remember it. I'm not concerned about 9/11 tonight. I am concerned about 30,000 young men and women being poured into a meat grinder. I'm concerned, Brian, about a son of mine who's 13 years old, not 15 feet from me, and the war that may still be hot and cooking when he gets old enough to be thrown into the meat grinder too. That's my concern, Brian.
Unleashed by September 11th.
Brian,
the
I don't
cause that. that is leading us into the continuing war in Afghanistan. I'm concerned for your son's safety, too. I'm concerned for the 30,000. I knew men killed in battles for this country for a man named Reagan who sent them to Beirut in 1983, where superpowers should never run peacekeeping missions. I think they should do, these troops, these 35,000 of them, Bob, they should go over each one of them and interview them. How many tours have you served in Iraq and Afghanistan? How exhausted are you? What is the, but the fact is, Bob, if this president is going to be honest, like the president before called it the central front of the war on terror, in that kind of situation, you have the courage to call up the draft, or you're not being real, you're a lying.
And that is, and that is,
was and is.
And that is, and right there is the central issue for this evening. We had a single man who occupies the presidency of the United States declaring more war, so to speak, on an absolutely benighted country. We are talking about an undeclared war, and if we are ever going to get to the bottom of anything, Brian,
Jeremy,
it's going to
happen. Ambassador of the United Nations from 1998 to 2003 said that President George W. Bush had no interest in attempts to agree on a UN resolution to provide explicit backing for the conflict in Iraq.
I understand that. And what I'm getting at here is that whether it's George W. Bush, Brian, or whether it is Barack Hussein Obama, Brian, I can't.
The momentum continues because it's called September.
Brian. I have muted you because you will not engage in dialogue here. Now, I refuse to try to talk over people on this program. What I was attempting to say is that at the core of all of this, we have wars that were declared by presidents in direct contravention of the means by which war is declared under the Constitution. If we wish to escalate this war, if we want this war to be real, then the Congress needs to get off its lazy ass and declare war on Pakistan or declare war on Afghanistan. But I am not going to sit here any longer and pretend, whether he be a Democrat or a Republican, that a president has the right to declare war, because it does not exist in the Constitution.
What have I said? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
What have I said, Bob, that has defended Barack Obama tonight in his speech and his escalation of the 35,000 troops? I'm not for any of that.
I didn't say I didn't say you were defending it. You simply would not participate in conversation.
Okay, I'm sorry about it. I'll close with somebody wiser than myself. This is Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Did you get his email today?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I just
I read it, in fact.
Okay, if you read it, then I'll go by his words and just say the last couple of lines there. An escalation of the war in Afghanistan. This is Dennis Kucinich. At a time of such economic dislocation and hardship, raises questions about America's priorities and whether or not we are losing our way as we attempt to stride the globe as some colossus. Tomorrow we begin anew the discussion. End quote. And I hope we can. And I'm sorry about my. I've known people that have suffered and died in the military, Bob. It's an emotional issue for me, too. God love your son. I want him to live in a peaceful America. It should have been so if they hadn't stolen this December 12, 2000 election for this inbred blue blood thing. George W. Bush is totally unqualified.
Amen.
God love you, sir. I'm sorry for interrupting so much.
No. That's okay. It's just, you know, I want to have a conversation, yeah. And it's got to go both ways. Thank you, Brian.
Good night, sir.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You know, and I personalize it by talking about my kids because that's what I've got. That's where my world is. But it's not just my kids. It's people you know. It's your kids. It's your grandkids. In some instances, it may be your great-grandkids. And every time, with every dollar that flows across the globe to the seemingly bottomless pit in Afghanistan, the likelihood of a good life for your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, children as yet unborn and undreamt of, becomes a little less likely. We're not securing any national security in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan will be Afghanistan. And the most you can do is go over and kill some bad guys once in a while. But you don't send 100,000 human beings after 1,000.
to work that way. You want to occupy the country? Occupy the country, but be honest enough to say you're not. Don't send forces to occupy a country and then say, we're not occupying. If you're only there for a month and a half, you're an occupier. I expect the other side to play word games with human lives. I had hoped in 2008 that we were going to get past that. That we were past freedom fries and freedom toast, and they hate us because we've got 267 channels of cable! But it is more than apparent that we are not. If there was one quote out of the whole speech that just stuck in my craw like a bone, it was this. What we fight for is a better future for all our children and grandchildren. It doesn't get, it cannot get any more Orwellian than that. Because if you cannot fight for peace, you cannot have, you can't dry clothing with water. You can't have drowning for swimming. Not in a war of choice. And Barack Obama has chosen this war. A few more emails before we roll out. Marty says, you'd said that JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X were murdered for their principles, impeding the way of the military-industrial complex. Back then, it might have been easier to off someone than it is now. It is easier, more effective now to destroy a person, let them live, but take away their credibility. Can we say Dennis Kucinich in the UFO question? In the eyes of the people. Suppose, though, whatever threat there might be to Obama be not directed at him personally, but at his family. What better way to take control of someone than to threaten harm to one's children? And with all such threats, you cannot resign. What's to say that what might have happened to, say, Diana in Paris happened to the kids wherever? Last week's breach of White House security must indicate just how easily a breach in security can happen, especially since there were actually people with guns outside of venues where Obama speaks. I don't know, Bob. Just trying to look at a different angle. By the way, just how free are we if, while disengaging from the political process, the teabaggers take control? Like flies around dog mess, you know the teabaggers and birthers will be there for those who pass their test of purity. May it not be as bad as it seems it will. And I'm not saying abandon, let me be clear then. I'm not saying abandon the political process. I'm saying that as of this moment, we are absolutely 100% unfettered and free to go in the political process where our morals take us, not where some cynical calculus of political preference takes us. Where our morals take us, our consciences. From William, Obama talks about the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan as if we're talking about Kansas, Texas, and New Mexico. I've seen that border Obama spoke of. No walk in the park by a long shot. He spoke of allies, and his speech began with 9/11. You get my drift. Most of all, I watch the faces of all the young cadets. Why is it I get the feeling they do not feel hopeful about this escalation? I saw those faces, too, and I was touched by the fact that that was not a group of young people
I mean, they've had, you know, they've had anywhere between 3 months to nearly 4 years of indoctrination at West Point. They weren't sitting there ramrod straight. They were sitting there with looks of profound concern on their faces. From Vince, never again will I allow someone to tell me they are for change. Never again will I believe that a politician is going to be interested in my best interests. Never again will I mistake well-spoken for intelligent. Carve that one in stone, that last one. Never again will I mistake well-spoken for intelligent. And Brian, don't sweat it, friend. I don't mean to overplay my hand, but it feels like everything's changed now, and perhaps it has. As I said, there may not be a show tomorrow night. I'm not entirely certain. Welcome, by the way, to December. Welcome to our continuing efforts to keep this little exercise in free speech on the air. Thank you for joining in tonight. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, your ideas, your phone calls, your emails, your time in the chat room. Thank you. Thank you for your ongoing financial contributions that keep this going. I don't know if I can ever adequately express the gratitude. Thanks to Peter Godbold, John Fox, Ben Birch, all the moderators, our blogger, News Ninjas. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. The hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I'm hoping that this evening will be an opportunity for collegiality, concourse, common cause, that kind of thing. conversation beyond what conversation radio ordinarily is. This is a freighted evening, brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors. This is a freighted evening. Here in about 2 hours, President Johnson, I mean Obama, is going to commit more troops to Afghanistan. And therein, Obama, is going to announce to the world that he has no intention of seeking re-election to the presidency of the United States in 2012, no matter what the timeline may say. In about 2 hours, Obama, is going to lift his elegant middle finger at the middle class and working class and lower class of this country and say, "Hey, you know, it's what you are. Welcome to plebehood." In about 2 hours, Obama, dang, why do I keep confusing the two? I don't know. But in about 2 hours, President Johnson, all right, this is getting silly. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to make health care less likely. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to put the final nail through the coffin of any hope for universal single-payer health care in my lifetime and probably yours, no matter how young you may be. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to put the hopes of making real progress on the otherwise debilitating killing of this planet practically nil. In about 2 hours, President Obama is going to make college a lot less affordable for working and middle-class families. Middle-class, what's left of it. In short, in about 2 hours, President Obama is going to tell all of America, "Who gives a F what you think?" We've heard somebody else make that statement before, haven't we? If you think that I find some joy in saying something like this, you are sadly mistaken. I voted for Barack Obama. I advocated his election. I didn't have any money to give him. But I did everything in my power, and I have taken hell in this little race-baiting community where I live for my vote. My children have been called nigger lovers because we voted for Barack Obama. We have stood up for Barack Obama, and Barack Obama is telling us to shove it. Now, I am not in the least prone to say, "Well, you know, that's it. I'll never vote for him again." I won't do that. I don't like operating that way. But I will say this. He is making it incredibly difficult to continue to support him. Everything in the world points away from the disastrous path that he is about to take and will take tonight at the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York. Everything. And yet he will. I have children, you know.